And we welcome the stations along the network to Primetime Sports here on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet. I'm Mike Wilner, sitting in for Jeff Blair, who is sitting in for Bob McCowan. Jeff Blair will be back tomorrow and Friday. Bob will be back next Tuesday.
We think. I think it's still in the hanging in the balance, perhaps, isn't it?
They were intimating something like that with Blair yesterday. I am confident that Bob will be back on January the 3rd.
Well, we hope so. Otherwise, Blair has the Wally Pipp opportunity here, doesn't
otherwise,
he?
Otherwise, yeah, well, maybe they'll call me again. And I think they're probably a little afraid of that. That's Stephen Brunt, whose voice I'm sure you recognize.
And I won't be here Monday, so there you go.
Well, but you're here today, which
I am
is
here
a
today.
Fantastic thing. Very, very excited about that. And we're also very excited about our next guest. And you knew I was going to say that whether we were or not. But we actually do like Joe Sheehan a lot. Joe Sheehan of SportsIllustrated.com joins us to talk a little bit about baseball. Thank you for joining us, Joe.
Hey, guys. Happy holidays.
And the same to you. And a happy new year upcoming. I want to talk about a lot of things. But the first thing, I guess, even though we kind of brought you on to talk about what the Yankees are doing, a trade just broke an hour ago. So the Red Sox pick up a closer in Andrew Bailey. They pick up a right fielder in Ryan Sweeney, who's a very good defender and a solid on-base guy with no power at all. And they give up three young players, including Josh Reddick, who I'm assuming, because he was a Red Sox prospect, has been talked about as, you know, an unlimited ceiling guy for the last 12 to 18 months. Tell me what you think about this.
Well, I mean, I think it's a good trade for the Sox. Certainly in the short term, you look at getting Bailey to go into the ninth inning with Melanson moving up to the eighth. They're looking to make Daniel Bard a starter, and I think that'll help the depth in the starting rotation. I think they're still in the market for a starter, although they might be more inclined to sign a guy now than necessarily make a trade. Sweeney ends up being the guy for them who comes. He might start right field. I mean, Ryan Kalish will probably be their right fielder for most of the season. Sweeney, though, you put an outfield out there of Sweeney, Ellsbury, and Crawford. That's really a fantastic defensive unit. So, you know, the Red Sox get the big benefit from this. They'll be able to control Bailey for the next 3 years, which is another big key. Now you look at Bailey and Melanson, and you've got guys. You know that you can have those three guys there for the next few years. From the A's side, you know, it's consistent with everything else they've done this offseason. They picked up A.J. Cole, who's 20 years old, in the Gio Gonzalez deal. Jared Parker is very young. In this trade, they get a Dominican right-hander named Raul Alcantara, who actually won't turn 19 until – actually just turned 19, I should say. And all of these things are designed so that the A's can kind of be ready to compete come, say, 2014, maybe 2015, when I think they're hoping to be in a new ballpark in San Jose. Everything Bean has done has been pretty consistently pointed towards a three-year time horizon. So they're kind of punting the next couple of years, which is why they've traded two starting pitchers and their closer. Alcantara, you know, it's something of a lottery ticket. You know, when you're that young and you're that far from the majors, you've got a first baseman, Miles Head, who kind of a small guy for a first baseman, not sure how well that's going to work out. And, you know, you mentioned Reddick. Josh Reddick has a career 293 OBP above AA. So I guess he's a prospect, but he's certainly not one that I'd be looking to pick up.
Man, they're going
to
be lining up for tickets in Oakland, then, aren't they?
We'll
be good in 2014 in another city.
And you're basically advertising. I mean, this is the closest thing we've seen to what the Marlins did over a few years ago, where basically instead of being about trying to put a winning baseball team on the field and win a championship, you're now making your franchise about trying to get a new ballpark. And the circumstances are a little bit different because the A's have a case that they want to move to a place that's going to support the team, that has more money, you know, get to San Jose. And MLB and the Giants have stood in the way. Now there might be a breakthrough. There are other issues, but it really is the first case in a while of a team basically saying we're just not trying for the next couple of years.
Do you have any insight as to why it has never worked in Oakland? I mean, when they were winning World Series in the early 70s, people weren't showing up. When they had the Bash Brothers and they were getting to the World Series in the late 80s, people weren't showing up. What's the deal? Is it that crappy a ballpark? Is it that bad an area? Does everybody want to be in San Francisco? What's going on?
I disagree. I mean, when they've succeeded, they've actually drawn pretty well. Not tremendously. They're the second team in a two-team market. They're not in an area that, you know, is necessarily a ton of business. They don't do a whole lot of, you know, the luxury boxes and stuff. They also were really killed when they redesigned that ballpark. I was in that ballpark, God, guys. I want to say 1992. 1992. And it was before they rebuilt it for the return of the Raiders, and it was really a nice ballpark.
It wasn't bad anyway. And you had kind of the view of the hills in the background, and it was okay.
It was a baseball park.
Yep.
And when the Raiders returned from Los Angeles and they built Mount Davis, it changed the whole nature of the stadium and really made it a less enjoyable place to go. Now, again, you know, when they win, they've done okay. But like a lot of teams, you know, they just don't seem to get a whole lot of bounce from that. There's not like a 2 or 3 year window. But, you know, when you're basically announcing you're not going to be any good, that really is what cripples you. There's just no hope going into 2012, 2013. And honestly, that becomes a cycle. You know, when you can't get any, but when you know going into a season, you really start to lose fan base. They've also had, like, smaller issues. Like, their radio broadcasts are really like a second-tier radio station. So it's hard to actually get a lot of coverage, whereas the Giants are on KNBR, which is like a million-watt, you know, blowtorch. I think you guys can hear it up in Toronto. So you put a lot of those things together, and they've been the second team. Now, if they go to San Jose, they'll have access to a more lucrative local market. They'll have access, presumably, to a lot of, you know, Silicon Valley corporate money for, you know, skyboxes and things like that. Plus, they won't be competing with the Giants. They're hoping to be that area's first, you know, team other than the Sharks. Kind of, whereas you're not the second team anymore. You're the first team. So I think there's a lot of reasons why that would work. I think that would be a successful move for the A's. But we are talking about a 3-year time horizon before it can happen.
Now, to change subjects for a second, there's been a lot of Prince Fielder talk hereabouts, and I guess in other places. And in the last day or so, we've had a report come out that said Prince Fielder was ready to talk about a 3-year deal and then have a second crack at free agency 3 years from now. And then we've had that quickly denied. You know, in terms of the Blue Jays' interest, term seems to be all important. Where do you think we actually are in the Prince Fielder sweepstakes?
I think Prince Fielder and Scott Boras have to be stunned by what's happened here. And it's just a circumstance of, you know, where all the teams that would normally be spending money are. Either they have first basemen and DHs, or they're not spending money at this point. Or in the case of the Cubs, it's just an awkward fit given where they are competitively. I think Fielder may have to choose between not so much short-term and long-term, but between getting the money and the deal he would want and playing for a winning franchise. Now, I don't mean that to slam the Jays, but even if the Jays sign Fielder, they're probably still the fourth best team in that division. And while I love what they're doing long-term, I'm not sure necessarily Fielder, you know, you're talking about a guy who's in his peak. He wants to win now. He's gotten a taste of that with the Brewers. Does he necessarily want to go to a team that's going to be building? I won't say rebuilding, but building over the next couple of years when he's going to be at his peak. I think it's a really awkward situation for him as a player. The Jays might end up being his best option. You know, the best. You know, you look at the teams that are out there. You look at, you know, the Nationals, the Orioles, the Mariners. I mean, I literally was just on the air in Chicago, and it just doesn't make sense for the Cubs to sign him, even on some kind of 3-year deal. Actually, it makes less sense on a 3-year deal. Let me ask you this, guys: if it was going to be some kind of 378 type deal, if you're Prince Fielder, why make a 3-year commitment? Why not just make the 1-year commitment? Why not try to go out and get somebody to give you 1 in 25? And then get back on the market next year when you're still young enough to say that you're in your peak. If you sign for 3 years, doesn't that just split the difference in a way that works against you? You hit the market at 31.
Who's the candidate for a one year shell out for Prince Fielder kind of deal?
Oh boy, I think there's a lot of teams. Boy, you look at, I mean, the Rays. I mean, I don't know if they have the cash to do it, but if you put Fielder on the Rays, that really closes the gap, because the thing they're missing is that middle of the order power hitter behind Longoria. Almost anything, any of the teams in the National League, the National League Central, Beltran, the cutter of the Cardinals could do it at this point. I wonder if the Brewers could, even after signing. See, the problem is a lot of these teams that I might start thinking of and say, hey, they could do it, have spent money now. The Brewers with Ramirez, the Cardinals with Beltran and Furcal. You know, think about the Rangers. I've talked a lot about the Rangers. Prince Fielder, to me, and the Rangers are a phenomenal fit. And competitively, financially, in terms of him going to that ballpark, they can eventually move to DH. But as long as the Rangers might have to spend $51 million, just, you know, if they might have to write that check for Darvish and then pay Darvish $15 million next year, I'm not sure they'd be a candidate for this kind of deal. I think at some point you just run into a cash flow issue. So I think conceptually it's a great concept, but I'm not sure I can think of a team that could make that kind of commitment off the top of my head.
Which is really interesting, because you're looking at a guy whose numbers are off the charts, who's 27 years old, and it's a guy whose market appears to be completely drying up. The 3-year versus the 1-year argument, Joe, that I have heard and seems to make a little bit of sense to me. 3 years hence, you're almost out from under the Teixeira deal, and,
yep.
and the you know the maybe the Red Sox can be players again, and maybe he's more willing to DH at that point, and if he can get his money now and then sign another contract at 30, hitting spring training at 31, then he can still make a bucket load of money. But Scott Boras is doing his best to say no, that's not going to happen. But it really is. You know, might it not be better for him to reemerge in the market? He's taking the risk, obviously, of staying healthy the next 3 years. But when the big spenders have more options to spend their big money?
Well, it's not just health in the sense that, you know, what if he gets hurt? It's you look at Prince Fielder as a player we already suspect isn't going to age very well.
Right.
There's the history of his father. There's you just, I mean, I hate to be this guy, but you just look at him. And you wonder, what is he going to be like as a player at 31? If he signs a 7-year deal now, you can say, well, you're getting his peak and the front end of his decline phase. If you're signing Prince Fielder at 280-plus pounds at age 31, it's all decline phase at that point. I wonder what he's going to be able to get. Now, the unknown is, what does he do over the next 3 years? And we obviously have no way of knowing that. I think the fascinating thing about this, guys, is in an industry with 30 buyers and let's say 12 of those are, quote, big money spenders. This is what happens when you take 15% of that and disappear. How much of what we're seeing is the fact that two extremely large market, theoretically large revenue, large payroll teams are basically non-entities in terms of buying players right now, by which I mean the Mets and the Dodgers. Those teams are basically non-entities in terms of spending money on high-dollar baseball players. So you've really got such a squeeze because so much of you know the guys who the teams that drive payroll in these you know these high-revenue teams are just out of it. And I think this is the Fielder's kind of the victim of what we've seen with the bad ownership situations in New York and in Los Angeles because you needed those extra teams driving the market. They're just not there.
If you're the Jays, then good to get back to them, and you. And 3 years is on the table. Let's in theoretically, 3 years is on the table with Prince Fielder. And even if the third year of that 3-year contract is maybe when you think you've got a shot, but you're also trying to make a big splash in the marketplace at some point. You're trying to kind of reestablish yourselves as a big player in a major market. Do you make that deal?
I got to think about it. Part of the issue is I have a player in Adam Lind who I suspect is better than he's been the last couple of years. So your marginal upgrade isn't great. You've got a guy in Travis. So you've got a couple of left-handed hitters you're still trying to bring along. Obviously, Fielder is better than either one of those guys. But if you're trying to build a team, do we maybe focus on center field? Or you know, a position where you don't necessarily have that long-term solution. It's really tempting, though, because the big thing about free agent contracts is usually the problem of the back end. And if you can get a player only for his peak, that's incredibly tempting. And I got to tell you, you know, they obviously were in on Darvish. You know, I haven't heard a straight answer yet as to what they actually bid on Darvish. But I don't think money's an issue for the Jays right now. I think that I don't think it's a situation where they can. I think it's really considering, you know, do we want to do this for the next couple of years? Guys, you know better than I do. Would signing Prince Fielder return the money in terms of additional interest in tickets sold and eventually selling ads on the network? Do you think just in that alone, the Fielder deal might pay for itself?
It's a complicated proposition.
Yeah, I don't think there's ever been a player in Toronto who has raised attendance. When Roger Clemens was here, attendance didn't go up significantly on the days he pitched. Roy Halladay, Jose Bautista. So I don't think that sort of a deal would pay for itself, but
you know,
it would
Mike,
really take advantage of it.
It's more of a, it's
right
kind
now.
Of a holistic thing though, right? Because you're talking about not just putting people in the seats, because which is tricky, but this is the same company owns them as a television property and as a radio property. And it's about kind of where you are in the marketplace.
Right.
And I think holistically, I think it would make have a huge impact.
There's
on the
Jays. There's this buzz happening right now, and Prince Fielder would just add a whole other dimension to it. And I think in 3 years, over the course of 3 years, that's something that the Blue Jays would be very, very interested in doing as opposed to a 7 or an 8-year thing. At what point, though, Joe, does the upgrade in what you're getting from Prince Fielder over a resurgent Adam Lind or even over a Carlos Pena, you know, become worth the extra $20 million.
Yeah, that's the hard part. And again, because we're talking about a first baseman, at his best, to use the sabermetric, you know, analysis of it, Fielder has been worth about 6 wins over a replacement level player. He's bounced around between about 4 and 6. Remember, you're not getting a whole lot of defense. You're not getting base running. You're not getting positional value. His value is his bat. And when you're comparing him to a guy like, you know, Lind, who's, you know, at his best been a 2-win player, you're talking about making the team maybe 4 wins better for that additional, you know, $22, $23 million you might be spending. And that's where it becomes hard. I mean, that's a little bit more than you want to spend for a win, just, again, to look at it sabermetrically, especially for a team like the Jays, where I'm not sure this move even makes them. If you tell me the Jays are an 85-win team that can get to 89, maybe it makes sense. I think the Jays in that division against those teams are probably an 82-win team that can get to 86. And the difference there is you're still not talking about making the postseason. And by 2014, might they be that team? Honestly, it almost depends as much on the other teams in the division as it does them. But I do think you can look and say, you know, the Yankees are certainly going to have an age issue. The Red Sox are getting older. We saw last year the fragility of some of their players. I can project a pretty bright future for the Jays. So if you want to say, you know, we'll make a 3-year deal with an eye towards actually winning in 2014, maybe contending for that extra playoff spot in 2013, I think you can make a case for that based on if you make the playoffs, guys, then that's where your big cash comes in. The problem is, are you going to make the playoffs with Prince Fielder? I'm still not convinced that you will.
I guess it depends on what you think of Colby Rasmus and Kelly Johnson.
God,
and
I forgot. You know, when I said center field, I forgot about Rasmus, guys.
Yeah,
I apologize.
I you did.
And I love Colby Rasmus.
Right, and see, it depends on those guys and Travis Snyder and Brandon Morrow and Henderson Alvarez and Kyle Drabek and all of that, because like you said, it does seem to be a team that's on the upswing. And
there's so many high variance players there. All that whole list is guys who could be worth collectively in a given year 8 wins or 22 wins. Mm-hmm. And I can't sit here. I mean, guys, you know, we all do this. We talk about baseball. We analyze players. And I can't tell you with certainty what that group of players is going to be worth over the next couple of years. It's a good situation to be in because you'd rather have guys with upside, but, you know, and do you take the chance? And if you're the Jays, that's an argument for signing Fielder. Because let's say Rasmus and Alvarez, and let's say Brandon Morrow finally figures out why they're hitting 360 on balls and play off them. All of a sudden, you've got a team that, with Fielder now, has that 91-92 win upside. And now with that extra playoff spot next year, they could get themselves into a one-game situation. Would you take your chances? One game against the Yankees, Ricky Romero against CC Sabathia for a playoff spot.
Yeah, let's go.
Yeah, I'll take it.
That's the argument for signing Prince Fielder.
And I'll take it at Yankee Stadium, too, with Travis Snyder and Colby Rasmus and my Prince Fielder in my left-handed power. It's definitely something to think
and
about.
And there's the other thing I want to mention here, too, is I think Alex Anthopoulos has done a fantastic job as GM. And if he signs Fielder, that's not the last move he's going to make. It might be the last free agent signing he makes. But he's still going to be out there trying to acquire talent. You know, it's not Fielder being added to a fixed roster. I would expect him to have added more talent by 2013, by 2014. I have a lot of faith in him. So, you know, this might be a situation where, you know, if there's going to be a spot to spend money where you wouldn't have to make that 6 or 7 year commitment. Guys, I'm kind of stumbling a bit only because I don't know what the right answer is. This is a fascinating situation with a very intriguing player, with an organization that might have an opportunity here to get a player they normally wouldn't get because of the special circumstances.
What are the Jays? How much do you think they're in on Matt Garza?
I don't think that's really. I think they really want to focus on the bat. And I look at the other teams out there for Garza. And I look at the price of pitching. I'm not sure the Jays are the target audience there.
They keep talking about one starting pitcher, one bat. We will see as it goes. We're with Joe Sheehan of SI.com, Mike Wilner and Stephen Brunt here. Joe, before we let you go, I want to get into the Hall of Fame thing a little bit with you. The 2012 ballot, people are talking about it now. It's January. We're going to find out soon. Barry Larkin got the highest percentage of the vote last year who didn't get in. The first-year guys, there's nobody overwhelming this year. You know, maybe there's that pull for Bernie Williams. It's the same pull as there is for Don Mattingly. It looks like maybe Larkin, maybe Jack Morris gets in this year, which I'm not terribly excited about. He's only got 2 years left on the ballot. I want to know what you think of those guys. I also would love to know what you think of Tim Raines and what you think of what's going on with Jeff Bagwell.
Well, let me work backwards here. Bagwell should be in the Hall of Fame. And even for the PED truthers, He should be in the Hall of Fame. There's never been anything connecting him. There's not even like the fringy Sammy Sosa type evidence with him.
That is congratulations on PED Truthers. I'm not sure if you invented that, but that's fantastic.
To interject here, what kills me about Bagwell, and I mentioned this yesterday too, is that in the late 90s and the early part of this century, the writers were saying, yeah, we know something's going on. We can't prove it, so we can't write it till we can prove it. With Bagwell now, it's, you know what, we kind of think he was doing something, so we're not going to put him in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, it's an utterly ridiculous argument. Jeff Bagwell should go into the Hall of Fame as one of the top, in a deep era for first baseman, he brought a lot to the table. He wasn't just, I talked about Fielder just being a bad first guy. He played defense. Mm-hmm. He ran the bases. He was a fantastic complete player. Bagwell should be in. Raines should be in as well. Raines only suffers largely from a direct comparison to Ricky Henderson, but Raines was a terrific player. Raines also got completely screwed a couple of times. In 1987, he should have been the MVP, but because of collusion, he had to miss the first month of the season. Mm-hmm. He would have been the National League MVP had he got that month, and there was nothing he didn't do anything wrong. The owners were colluding. Eventually, had to pay $250 million because they colluded. So, nothing again. Raines should be in the Hall of Fame. You asked me a couple
of Larkin and Morris for the others.
Larkin's in. Not only is Larkin and Raines, guys. In fact, I'll throw Bagwell into this too. It's not even like they're in the Jim Rice way, where they're kind of over the line of the lowest level Hall of Famers. Mm-hmm. Those three guys actually raise the level of player in the Hall of Fame. Now, all those guys should be in because they're above the average Hall of Famer in terms of value. So throw all those guys in. Larkin. Raines,
the second greatest pitcher of the 1980s, Jack Morris.
Yeah, Jack Morris should not be in the Hall of Fame. Jack Morris is a myth. I did this whole research piece. People can Google it. Just Google Jack Morris Project. They kind of looked at his entire career to say, did he pitch to the score? And no, he didn't. There's no evidence that he pitched to the score. He was a durable pitcher who happened to pitch for teams with extremely good offenses for a long time. And that's why, you know, he had 254 wins, which even in and of itself isn't a great Hall of Fame record. His postseason record wasn't that great. Remember the one great start. He had good postseason outings, he had bad ones. Nothing. Jack Morris would drag down substantially the level of the Hall of Fame. And if Jack Morris is in, he opens the door to a whole bunch of pitchers better than him.
Can you put a guy in the Hall of Fame who gave up a home run to Lonnie Smith in the World Series?
Well, here, you mentioned Lonnie Smith. If we put Jack Morris in the Hall of Fame, I sincerely hope he thanks Chuck Knobloch. Because if Chuck Knobloch
right.
doesn't deke Lon Lon at second base,
the year before,
we're not having
that's
this
right.
discussion today. Bernie Williams, I'm actually a Bernie Williams truther, to go back to that. Here's the case. It's not a New York Mattingly thing. We have started emphasizing postseason in a way that we never had before. Even in the, you know, go through 93, winning the division mattered. You cared. Now we don't care. We only care about the postseason. Mm-hmm. Bernie Williams played an entire season's worth of at-bats in the postseason for teams that won. If we're going to emphasize postseason the way we have under Bud Selig, you've got to give credit to guys for how they performed. So while Williams doesn't necessarily get there in his regular season performance, that high performance in these high-intensity, high-leverage games for almost a full season's worth of them has to matter. I think Schilling gets helped by that. I think Smoltz gets helped by that. Chipper Jones doesn't need it, but he would get helped by that. There are going to be a handful of guys, so you have to take that seriously for. Bernie's one of them. There was one other guy you asked me about.
I think that was it. I thought about asking you about Edgar Martinez, and as a Canadian, I'd love to ask you about Larry Walker, but I think he's going to get Colorado'd right out of the Hall of Fame.
Even if it's not just that. I mean, the lack of durability hurts him. If you're going to be, I mean, I want to say that with like 7,800 at bats, 7,800 plate appearances, that's short for a corner outfielder. If Walker's a bit like Larkin, where the durability is the thing that kills him, but Larkin managed, because Larkin was a shortstop and he did manage to play longer, that helped him. I think Walker really needed a few more healthy seasons. The short career is what kills him. Edgar, I don't have Edgar in, and a lot of the stat heads really get on me about this, and I don't mean that pejoratively. I'm one of the stat heads, but it's one of these situations where, like, your stat heads all support a position and you don't. It can be a little dangerous when I walk down the street. If you're going to be a bat-only player, I think you've got to have some more longevity. And Edgar Martinez combines a lack of longevity with no defensive or speed or any other kind of value. On a per-at-bat basis, obviously gets in, but I'm not giving him credit for the Mariners being dumb and not playing him. And I can't give him, you know, to say that Frank Thomas loses value for his defense or Bernie Williams loses values for his defense, but Edgar Martinez doesn't, is counterintuitive to me, because if Martinez could have played the field, he would have been a minus 15 or whatever anyway, and his case wouldn't look so good. So I combine all those things, and I have Martinez just on the other side of the line.
That's our fault, by the way.
That's
Edgar blew out his hamstring at BC Place in a spring training
That's
exhibition.
That's right. That's absolutely right on that horrible turf.
Yeah, so we apologize on behalf of Canada.
Well, you know, it's not just that. I mean, the Mariners could have played him 2 years before they did, and they just didn't get. It was a little bit like Wade Boggs, where Wade Boggs didn't get to the majors because the Red Sox didn't recognize what they had. The Mariners were playing Jim Presley at third base, and I think if you give Edgar two extra years at third base, it changes his case. But you can do that with a lot of different guys. You got to look and do what the player actually did. You know, I think Martinez. It's not that a DH can't be in the Hall of Fame. It's that a DH-only player, and Martinez is really the first career majority DH to come up because Mahler played first and all these other guys actually played other positions. And you've got to have some more longevity than he showed.
Joe, we got to go. This has been a blast. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys. Have a happy new year, and I'll talk to you on the other side.
You bet. Joe Sheehan from SI.com. Doug McClain will join us as Primetime Sports continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Welcome back to Primetime Sports. I'm Mike Wilner, in for Jeff Blair, who's in for Bob McCown. Blair will be back tomorrow. Stephen Brunt, my co-host. And Doug McClain joins us.
Who's not in for Kiprios.
In for Kiprios.
Yeah,
yeah, no. He's
at the basketball game.
Is that right? Yeah. Is he got one of those courtside seats? I bet he does.
I said, somebody said, why is he at the basketball game? I said, who's the guy he fought that ended his career? That's probably, anyway, we won't go there.
Alrighty.
I bet he's right down front.
I'm Air sure Canada Club. No, he goes there for dinner. Blair he goes for a free dinner.
Blair's there too, which is why I'm here, I guess. And we have you here to talk a little bit of hockey. But I know you were so fully engrossed in whether or not Edgar Martinez belongs in the Hall of Fame. And, you know, the fact that his wins above replacement don't stand up well with Paul Mahler.
I nodded off three times coming down Mount Pleasant in a car with that Sheehan guy on. Oh, my God, I was ready to drive off the road.
I need you to get into baseball, Doug. I need you to get into baseball.
Yeah, it's just get Fielder done and let's move on. I mean, Anthropoulos, he's Kiprios's boy, buddy. I mean, get it done. What's the hold up?
You were a president and a GM.
It's only money.
Yeah.
Would
mine.
You spend that kind of money in a capitalist league to take advantage of the buzz that's existing in your city?
Who was the guy that was last paid $28 million here that they had to dump?
Well, Vernon was making 21, 23.
23.
Different point in his curve, though, as a player, I would say.
Yeah.
But look, successfully introducing hockey to the people of Columbus, Ohio, and you felt that the market was just starting to bubble, and you were in a system, which you weren't, but in a system where you had a chance to, where you knew a guy would kind of at least push the intangibles in the market. Whether or not he would actually make you win, he would get people excited.
Especially when you're working for a group that just shelled out $500 million plus for the Leafs, whatever else goes with it. You know, that whole MLSE thing. You would think that there's got to be something going to the Jays here in a big way. And, they take the Jays seriously. They want to do it right. There's a plan in place. And that's the million-dollar question, is what is the plan? And does this deviate from the plan that was put in place when Alex and Paul Beeston took over? And I'm not convinced this was part of that plan.
I guarantee you this wasn't part of the plan, at least at seven or eight years. At three years, it might be.
And that's the question. So is Paul Beeston the sort of president that is going to deviate from that? I'm not convinced he is.
I'm just thinking you deviate from the plan sometimes because sometimes circumstances change.
And the time is right.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
If the time is right, and that will be the big challenge, and that would be major discussion. You'd know this a lot better than I would, but I mean, I've got to believe that is major discussion. Is it the time that we step out of the box and do something extraordinary
for the
fans and for a chance to take a step?
Right, but for the fans, what happens if Prince Fielder comes here on a 3-year deal, the Jays win 86 games and finish third in the American League East? Does it all turn back? Yeah. Is there a huge backlash?
Yeah, so you got to, but you may as well take a risk. You know, it's not like he's not going to.
That may be the likeliest outcome.
He's not going to make them worse, though.
But if the plan is in place that they're going to continue to get better, and that's the first year of it, the team in years two and three, if the plan is moving according to, mm-hmm. I mean, that would be what, five years for the, for Beeston and
Anthropolis? For Anthropolis, it'd be 5 years. Yeah.
Most plans are 5 years in pro sports. Yeah. I would think that if it, if the plan is moving as we've been led to believe it is, that if it's a, if it's third place this year or fourth place this year, where's year two and three of Alex and Paul Beeston's 4 and 5 year plan?
Yep.
We got Doug McClain to talk about
it's
baseball.
It's great. We got a whole other baseball segment out of this. Fantastic.
I am thrilled
more
by this.
More people have just driven off the highway. That's, I apologize.
I have to ask you to move on to the hockey, to the Leafs. And I know that Jeff Blair yesterday said...
You're hating doing this, but I, you know, it's okay.
Blair said yesterday that if the Leafs lose to Florida, we would be spending all day talking about what a, an issue with the Ron Wilson extension, what a mistake it was. But I don't want to get to that. But I do want to get to the power play because... The penalty kill. Yeah. Because I'm sitting here thinking, can they not sign Greg Therrien? I mean, is there nobody who can kill penalties anymore? How do you have 4 years with different crews and you still can't kill a penalty?
I don't get it. I really don't get it at all. And I, what's the reason? Well, there's a variety of reasons. You've got offensive defensemen in Lyles, who's not very good in his own end. So he's a problem guy, penalty killing. You've got Gardner, who's a great skater, but too young to be a real effective penalty killer. You've got Ollie, who's could be a great penalty killer, in my opinion, down the road, immature, young. Phaneuf, to kill penalties, you've got to be really, really smart in your own end. And Dion, in my opinion, has average hockey IQ in his own end. And Gunnarsson, to me, should be the ideal type of penalty killer because he's a smart guy. His feet are okay. So you've got a challenge here in your makeup of your back end. And that, to me, is the number one problem.
That's
and
not a coaching issue, though, Doug.
That's not a coaching issue. That's more of a personnel on the back end. And let's not forget, you know, they move. So you've got fleet guys that bring offense. And you got some slow-footed guys that are still young in Shen, Ollie, and so on. So, and up front, there's no excuse. There's no excuse that you can't find guys that kill. So, you know, I was thinking last night, what do they do to get around? If you're the coach, instead of rolling six forwards, like most teams do penalty killing, you call in eight guys. Four forwards, four defensemen, and we're going to do this for the next 10 days, we're going to play two groups of forwards, two groups of D. You guys get mentally, this is your goal. This is your job. This is your, you know, you're going to grab onto this and we're going to get out of this. And you put the system in place. That's a basic system, good positional play, aggressive when you can be, you know, get away from this aggressiveness all the time, but aggressive when you can be aggressive and passive when and see if they can build on some momentum. But this, it's just, I've never seen anything like it. I mean, penalty killing, I say to minor hockey coaches who don't play all their kids, I said, if you can't teach kids to penalty kill, you shouldn't be coaching. You know, so there's no reason for a kid sitting on the bench. So he can't be on the power play. Teach him how to be a penalty killer so you can get his ice.
But, Doug, these guys are doing, again, it's not, I think there's a, it's tempting occasionally to think, well, Ron Wilson's a dope. He can't figure this out. No, they're doing that. They're trying to kill penalties the same way everybody else in the league tries to kill penalties,
Totally. But it's you get yourself in a rut. It's like Eric Staal, who's the leading minus guy in the NHL. It's in his head. And now it's a major challenge to get it out of his head. And you're in so deep that how do you get out of it? Because you may go 5 games and be terrific. In game 6, you go 2 for 3 and you're back in 28th spot. So it's just, I say, forget the stats. You put the board up today. Okay, we're 0 on penalty killing in our dressing room. Now let's build on that. Where are we going to go? We're 100% today. Where are we going to be in 2 weeks' time or in 5 games? And let's roll it out. But they got to do something or they're not going to make the playoffs. That's the frightening part. The penalty killing could cost them the playoffs.
Yeah, well, or goaltending. If they don't get, like, if it was like it was last night, they're going to have to get goaltending.
And he's got like an 830 save percentage in his last 5 road games, I saw tonight, somebody said.
I got to ask you about the as much as the Leafs and Ron Wilson and his contract extension are a subject of endless fascination in Toronto. the Randy Cunningworth situation in Montreal, and just they took the heat off a little bit. They beat the heck out of Ottawa, but everything from the firing of Jacques Martin to the appointment of Cunningworth to the Jeff Molson statement, kind of cutting his legs out from under him, the benching of PK Subban as kind of a first coaching move. I'm not sure they could have made more of a hash of this in Montreal, which is the great not there, not here is the great pressure cooker in the National Hockey League. How'd you like to be Randy Cunningworth right now?
Well, I wouldn't. Well, I'd like to be drawing the $1 million.
That
a
part,
year.
Yes.
Yeah, or you'd like to be one of the 30 guys. But here's the thing: how do you in your right mind fire Jacques Martin, who's been in the NHL for 25 years? And yeah, Jacques may have some issues. Maybe he's not the most dynamic guy. Maybe some players are upset. But to fire Jacques Martin and to replace him with a guy in that mark, and I have all the respect in the world for Randy Cunningworth as a former player, as a minor league coach, yep, as an NHL assistant. If it's in the summer, somebody hires him, I think it may be a good move. And you do that to Randy Cunningworth, and you take Larry Carrière, who hasn't coached in 25 years, assistant GM, and or if he's ever coached at all, I don't know, he was Gauthier's assistant, and put him on the bench with him. I mean, are you out of your mind? Who made this decision?
That's the same guy who fired an assistant coach two hours before a game.
I'm not sold it was him that made the decision.
You think it was Jacques?
I'm not sold it wasn't the guy that made the comment about Randy Cunningworth.
Jeff Molson.
Well, I mean, seriously, does Pierre Gauthier, a hockey guy, make this decision? I don't get it. I mean, if you're going to fire Jacques Martin, you've got to have an amazingly experienced guy, boom, stepping in there.
Who you can put into that market and who can deal with it. Because it's not like coaching in Columbus, Doug.
Hey,
it
listen,
just isn't.
Do people not think that the French media... We're going to go ballistic over this move? I mean, who in their right mind wouldn't have thought about that?
This is the most predictable. That part is the most predictable thing that could have possibly happened.
And these guys are lifers with the Montreal Canadiens?
Yeah, I don't understand. Again, if it was Pierre Gauthier's decision.
It was a bad one.
I'm not sure why he has a job right now.
Oh, it's a bad one. But I'm not sold that it was his. But I mean, I fired two coaches in Columbus. And I had to swear that it was my decision. Now that I'm fired, it wasn't my decision. When I fired Dave King, I got to call 11 o'clock at night. You fire him tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And if you don't, we're never going to know until Gauthier's out of the game like me, and then you can tell the truth.
We got a minute left with Doug McLean, and I was just going to ask you, and you may have just answered it, but if you're Randy Cunningworth and your owner just cuts the legs out from under you, I know you want to be one of those 30 guys, and I know that salary is nice, but is there not a huge piece of you that's just saying, well, screw this, I'm out of here?
No, I'm going to prove them wrong. And you know what? Randy Cunningworth is a quality guy, and I think the players probably really like him, and I bet you the players are really ticked off about what's going on in the French media and all around them. If I'm Randy Cunningworth, I do a bang-up job. I do everything in my power to get this team in the playoffs. Let's not forget the last English-speaking guy that was a head coach there, Al McNeil. What, 71? All he did was win the Stanley Cup when he took over. And
then they got rid of him.
And they fired him right after the Stanley Cup.
Exactly.
So if I'm – but he had a lifetime career in hockey after. If I'm Randy Cunningworth, I get this team in the playoffs, and I put big-time heat on Gauthier, Molson, whoever else is making the decisions.
Sounds
good. Serge Savard, put it on all of them. I hope he makes it.
There he is, Doug McLean. We got
to
go. Thank you so much for your time.
Back to more baseball talk. I'm out of here.
Thank you for coming in studio.
It was great, guys.
It was lovely to have you. Yeah. Have a happy new year.
Happy new year, Doug.
It is the Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network. We are back on Primetime Sports here on the Sportsnet Radio Network and on Sportsnet. I'm Mike Wilner. Stephen Brunt is with me. I'm filling in for Jeff Blair, who's filling in for Bob McCowan. Jeff Blair will be back tomorrow. And I'll be co-hosting with him tomorrow and Friday. Stephen Brunt is going to enjoy some well-earned time away from the radio station.
Yes, I'm going to end some time going away in general. I'm disappearing for a few days. It's
good.
Much needed.
You've earned it.
Yes.
Without question.
And I say when I come back, I assume McCowan will be here, but we can't make any promises.
We are all keeping our fingers crossed.
We are. It's sort of like the Yu Darvish posting sweepstakes. We're all just holding our breath, waiting to see what happens.
Yes. Yes, we are. And we'll find out, I guess, next Tuesday. You turn on the radio at 4 o'clock.
If you hear a tone, that means he's not here.
It's all true. As we wrap things up here, there are a couple of things we could talk about. It's opening night, a Raptors home opener, and right now they're playing the Pacers, and they're losing. And they had a rough first quarter with 17 turnovers. They sent out Jamal McGlure, the first Canadian ever to suit up to the Raptors, to give the season opening address and promise energy. What do you think of that move?
Well, I think it's a lovely gesture, and it's interesting that it's great that they finally have a Canadian. Of course, Jamal McGlure is, for most Canadian basketball fans, is most famous for declining to play for Canada's national team.
Ever playing.
Yeah, at times when they could have used him and he might have made a difference. He was AWOL, I recall, so wave that flag when it suits you, pal, but... you know, I saw him play as a high school player. He was a monster. He was a great high school player.
He would have been. He would have looked great in a Canadian uniform.
Yes, he would have.
Several times. 10-second answer. Is there anything that comes out of the World Junior Hockey Championships except gold medal for Canada, or what the hell is wrong with hockey in this country?
That's it. Guaranteed win night or crisis night. There's no in-between. There's no glorious loss. We have to crush everybody.
Canada the Czechs coming up tonight. Thanks so much for listening. Back tomorrow, it is Primetime Sports on the Sportsnet Radio Network.